From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm the show's producer, Mary McIntyre, and this week I'll be your host. Each year, the Missouri School of Journalism faculty awards Missouri Honor Medals to journalists on the basis of lifetime or superior achievement. Past recipients include Tom Brokaw, Christiane Amanpour, Winston Churchill, and Gloria Steinem. Jim Flink, a professor of strategic communication, sat down with this year's medalists to talk about excellence in journalism and media. Today, we're featuring excerpts of those conversations on our show. Justine Nagin is the executive director of American Documentary Incorporated. She is also the executive producer of two series, POV on PBS and American Reframed on the World Channel. POV is the longest-running documentary series on television.
We are talking about excellence in journalism, and I just kind of want to pick up on that very last little bit about the importance for civic dialogue, and certainly nothing more important right now than what's going on in this nation, right?
I absolutely agree. I think any opportunity to bring people together to share their thoughts, their questions, their hopes, their dreams, all of that, I think any opportunity to do that is very important, especially today.
So let's talk about documentary as the opportunity. You know, we really spend a lot of time in this day and age talking about the ephemeral nature of communication and content, right? Social media, whatever it might be. And yet, long form is such an important platform, and the ability and the interest of audience to be able to access that, equally important.
For sure. And I think one of the great things about documentary, as you mentioned, is it lives on. So beyond its initial premiere, these films that often take years to make can go on to have impact for many years beyond the original release. I think also documentaries, especially long form, you know, have the potential to bring viewers into a story through an emotional, through a character-driven window into a current affairs story that they might not otherwise be attracted to.
And this August, you are actually launching or have launched with the New York Times a documentary about race. And wow, is that a hot topic?
It's a really exciting new initiative that's being supported by the MacArthur Foundation, where we'll actually be embedding a filmmaker at the New York Times in their race-related initiative. And so the filmmaker will be based there for approximately 3 months and really working with the on-the-ground reporting team to flesh out and go deeper into some of the stories that they're working on.
In your pre-interview with one of our students, you talked a little bit about the tumultuous nature of the current ecosystem that is news and media. Talk a little bit about that and about sort of multi-platform plays and how that fits into everything that you're doing.
Sure. I mean, the channels and the methods by which people are getting their media, getting their news, becoming informed about their world, they're changing all the time. And POV and public television, it's a historic medium, right? And so we're constantly trying to understand how can we serve our viewers, how can we serve the American public in the broadest sense of the word, whether that's through appointment television or whether that's through online streaming or shorts or interactive production. You know, we are really trying to think about how we maintain our mission and our core, but let the stories evolve and the storytelling devices evolve to make sure we're reaching the broadest audience.
We are so fixated sometimes on device, and I don't think I have two teenagers in my household, and I know which device they use as their primary device, and it's usually in their hand. The ability to really optimize against mobile devices in a longer form format, how's that going? And do you see that evolving and improving, or do you think it's still that sort of we gravitate to the biggest screen for our best experience?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think it's something that anyone working with media is grappling with right now. I mean, I think documentaries especially have the ability to draw people together, whether that's physically, you know, in a theater, in a library, in a prison even, to have a communal experience and share a story and then talk about it. One of the great things about television is you have a date for films and for campaigns to rally around and for people to really talk about it. Whether it's the premiere of Game of Thrones or a POV film, you know, kind of the water cooler talk, there is that temporal point for people to rotate around. And I think we're all trying to figure out how that works in a digital platform, how you, you know, reach kind of critical mass around a given release time.
And, you know, you think about binge watching and something like the Game of Thrones, and you think, you know, this isn't necessarily that appointment, that aforementioned appointment television. And yet there is very much a new tapestry, if you will, of communal experience that is shared across platforms, across space and time. And really, the challenge really is to be able to gauge and measure that in effective ways.
Absolutely. And really trying to keep track of who it is you're trying to reach and how they're accessing your stories. I mean, POV, you know, we are still so proud to be working with some of the best filmmakers in the business to bring these powerful, timely, long-form documentaries to millions of viewers across America with public television. But on the other hand, we're also producing a handful of Snapchat documentaries that, you know, the average age on Snapchat right now, even though it's rising, it's currently, I think, 13 to 17. So really trying to think about how do you take these character-based, powerful, often social justice stories and translate them to another medium.
33 Emmys, 18 Peabodys, 12 DuPonts, 3 Academies, and a George Polk Documentary Award, among others. And then you come to places like True False Film Festival right here in Columbia, Missouri, and build a different kind of audience. That's quite a record. Talk a little bit about film festivals and about the importance and the emergence of that sort of ecosystem, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, film festivals play a really important role in the independent film world, but particularly in the documentary ecosystem. I mean, really, it's often the launching point for a film. So for a filmmaker, it's oftentimes the first time that they have seen their film on the big screen and seen audiences interact with their film. And they do Q&As oftentimes. And so they'll be able to directly interface with people who have just engaged with their films. And for a filmmaker, that is a magical time. And for us, you know, we go to film festivals like True False to really look at what's out there and who are filmmakers we should know and what are films that we should be looking to bring to POV or America Reframed in our next season.
800 programs a year, and 400 of which live in public television. That's quite a lot.
Yeah, so, you know, each year we have an open call. Actually, this year I think we got so far over 1,200 submissions. And then there are films and filmmakers that we've been tracking and talking to around, you know, over the calendar year. But from those 1,200 submissions, you know, we have about 15 slots on public television. And so we're really forced to make some very difficult choices to program a given season. And then, yes, it's so exciting. And next year's our 30th year. And right now, I think the POV back catalog has 400 titles in it, which is an immense body of work and a really, for me, you know, coming in new to the organization, such a fascinating timeline to be able to watch kind of the issues of the day and how this organization has brought these issues to light for audiences across America.
There seems to be such a hunger, such a thirst, regardless of platform, regardless of audience, regardless of location, for really, really deep content. In terms of excellence, do you see emergent themes in the areas that you're working on that you think people should be looking out for in terms of any of those things, platform, subject, anything like that?
Whether you get your news from, you know, one of the big five networks or you get it from Facebook, I mean, I think that we're all kind of awash right now with some very serious issues that our country and our planet are facing right now. And I think sometimes it can get overwhelming. And I feel like one of the great things about a good documentary is it can be completely immersive. And whether or not it's a, you know, quote-unquote hopeful documentary, a lot of times just having a character or a family or, you know, an organization represent one of these huge mammoth issues and give you a new way to think about it makes that issue more manageable and makes you think about what kind of human, what kind of citizen, what kind of friend, you know, mother, daughter, son do I want to be.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. Today we're listening to conversations with winners of the Missouri Honor Medal awarded by the Missouri School of Journalism. Janice Min is the co-president and chief creative officer of the Hollywood Reporter Billboard Media Group. She has worked for People, Life, and In Style magazines.
Let's talk a little bit about excellence and how you define it, especially given the current landscape in media, which is ever-changing, it seems.
I would say the way we define excellence in what we do is pretty simple. Does your content that you create in whatever form make a difference? Does it have any impact? Does it reach anybody? And does it rise above the pack of all the noise that is coming at you 24 hours a day to be something somebody chooses to spend time with. And I don't think it's necessarily a standard that is specific to just people who are in journalism or media. It's really people who are in TV, in film, people who are trying to compete against the constant flood of information coming our way.
It's such a challenge, isn't it, in this landscape? You know, you see the emergent platforms and channels and sort of the, you know, the ebb and flow of popularity. Talking to my 15-year-old would not be the same, clearly, as talking to me in terms of social channels and that kind of thing. And it's really a challenge, isn't it?
You know, my job is to edit and decide what things are worthy and what things aren't worthy, both in what we churn out here, but also, you know, I find it increasingly hard to edit my own personal life. And we are in the so-called golden age of television. And there are times my husband and I, when we were trying to figure out what to watch, we sort of are like, wow, we have no idea. Like, you kind of don't want to make the wrong choice because it's a time commitment. So I think, you know, and it is really that the most excellent things are the ones that will be in my mind because I've heard them talked about somewhere else. I've heard people mention them. I know they were well reviewed. That is eventually what wins. At The Hollywood Reporter, there's this thing that I feel like has been a big part of the success here from when we relaunched in 2010, which is this notion that though we are not just doing stories, we're not just trying to do good stories, but we're also trying to get them across the finish line, is what we always call it, which is, you know, your story used to be done when you turned it into an editor and it went to either a printing press or posted online. And now it is, okay, how do you make that story come alive and reach the widest group of people? So the strategic part of the job, which used to not be necessarily as significant a part of the job, is in the sort of amplification of stories you believe in. And in any given day or any given week here, there are probably certain stories or pieces of content we do that we consider to be our most important, our most image-enhancing, things that we think represent our sense of excellence here. And so that involves how do we get other media outlets to take interest in what we're doing, write what we're doing? How do we put this out in the world in social media? Are there television partners we need to be going out to publicize what we're doing? And I think as anyone who works in media knows today, like, if you have the sound of one hand clapping on your story, you're dead. You need to have the whole afterlife after publication really make your piece something. And I think for us, we've had this, you know, we started out with this challenge of we're in Los Angeles, not exactly the media capital of the world, and we're producing content from an industry that would be very easy to dismiss as trivial and lightweight. One of the things we have done, and quite well, I'd like to think, is make our content relevant to a larger audience and also expanding the boundaries of what Hollywood is. And also using Hollywood as a way to get into the important political and social conversations of the day, knowing that Hollywood is often, whether you agree with it or not, offering a position of thought leadership on those topics. And, you know, you can look at something like Oscar So White, with the Oscar nominations from earlier this year that had all white acting nominees for the first time in 20 years. And Oscar So White sort of put a very, almost more digestible face on the issue of race that really overwhelmed the racial cultural conversation for months and months. You know, you would think that the composition, the ethnic and racial diverse composition of the voting members of the Academy, that it were like, you know, picking Supreme Court justices. It took on that level of social importance. And it's those kinds of stories that we take very seriously here, but we also take a lot of pride in knowing that these are stories that have a larger impact.
You know, I have to tell you that here at the Missouri School of Journalism, which is America's oldest, I am constantly surprised by the number of aspiring journalists who want to cover the very things that you just talked about. We have an emergent throng, if you will, of people who are interested in entertainment, sports, but I think they're not just interested in it in the fanboy or fangirl way, right? I think they very much look at the world through the prism of causality that is seen in, you know, whether it be motion pictures or whether it be on the field of play or whatever, and sort of the manifestation of life as sport, but also in telling those stories. Are you seeing that as well from your end? Like, are you flooded with applicants?
I wouldn't say flooded. By virtue of being in Los Angeles, they're not journalists beating down the doors to move to Los Angeles. I do think there is that intellectualization of entertainment and sports is huge. And, you know, the kinds of journalists who would never succeed here are the kinds of journalists who want to go on a red carpet and have a selfie taken with Jennifer Lawrence. Like, that is not what we do. And that is not the kind of journalism that will succeed today. I think the people who can impart meaning on really the two biggest connect fields that connect America and the world, you know, it's entertainment and sports, people who can impart meaning in those areas. Earlier this year, I received a Matrix Award, which is an award for women in communications. And on the stage was also getting an award was Lena Dunham. And she was getting her award presented to her by Gloria Steinem. It really struck me. The feminists of today are not intellectuals. They're not coming out of universities. They are coming out of Hollywood. Like, if you think about people in the last year who have driven so much important discussion on that topic, it's Lena Dunham, it's Jennifer Lawrence, it's Amy Schumer, people who have probably radically shifted the way that we look at women's roles in society, in movies, in television, in the way, in equal pay. And that's where you really see the significance of social media and being able to amplify the messages of people who the larger world are already very interested in. I could say the same thing about issues of race. Chris Rock wrote an unbelievably powerful piece for us for one of our cover stories about being black in Hollywood. And I do think that was a real turning point in the conversation of awareness of discrimination, of who gets what roles in this city right now.
I find all this fascinating because, you know, my 15-year-old, he consumes almost everything on Snapchat, and really to the expense of almost everything else. And yet if I'm going to talk to him about some current event, some current issue, he can talk very knowledgeably based upon the content that he has consumed largely on Snapchat. I think that's fascinating. It provokes a lot of hope for me.
I think that there's probably a misconception that if you have an important story, it has to be told in 3,000 words.
Right.
I think that we're seeing that is not necessarily, and certainly probably definitely not even the majority of times, the case. I think there are people who want to pull their hair out to think that somehow Snapchat, with all the, you know, people with unicorns coming out of their mouth and all these things, that somehow this is the new way that, you know, an ADD generation communicates. You know, look at the current time we are in right now and the election, and I've never seen more young people incredibly engaged in the discussion. Listen, we've all had leisure pursuits in our life. You know, I think when I was growing up, I probably melted my brain every Saturday night watching Love Boat into Fantasy Island. I mean, I watched hours and hours and hours of television. I think that those external stimulation that kids and younger people need are the same ones we had, which doesn't mean that you're turning an intellectually curious person stupid. I just think these are the new forms of entertainment. I've always been very heartened. If you look at the brands that matter the most today, nothing killed the legacy brand. I think there's probably not a person alive who thinks that if they don't want to make the biggest impact with a certain kind of story, that it shouldn't be in the New York Times,
right,
or the Wall Street Journal, or the Washington Post. So I don't think you have yet someone saying, you know, boy, I really need to get my message out through Mashable. You know, I mean, and that's not demeaning Mashable.
No,
just saying they do a different thing. But that the sort of essence of news gathering, content creation, and that kind of authority and credibility, they probably actually matter more today than we've ever thought they would. Because, it's sort of which brands rise above the pack to mean something. And you know what? I don't need to read the eighth derivation of a New York Times story. I'd rather just read the New York Times story. So in some ways, it's actually incredibly clarifying. It's almost a filter through which you run all this noise. And, you know, where am I going to spend my time? I'm going to spend my time with my highest quality friends and also, you know, my highest quality content available to me. But we'll often just go after interviews we know are going to matter that day. We will go after, for example, you know, this is an incredible broadening of probably what the Hollywood Reporter traditionally has done. We've sent people to the conventions, the political conventions, knowing that Hollywood is incredibly invested in these elections, that we have a reality television candidate in Donald Trump. These conventions are going to greatly impact the success, the rise and fall of different media outlets and personalities out of New York, who will be covering the conventions, that we can't really any longer as an outlet look at those sort of events and say, we're not part of that because we cover movies and television out of Los Angeles. But looking at that and saying, okay, like, we are the Hollywood Reporter. We have the authority to do this, and no one's going to look at this and say, what? They are at the conventions? And in fact, that hasn't just not been the case, because we've been able to sort of broaden our boundaries, you know, in a way that feels right for us and in a way that feels right for the audience.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. Today we're listening to conversations with winners of the Missouri Honor Medal awarded by the Missouri School of Journalism. Connie Frazier is the Chief Operating Officer of the American Advertising Federation. She also leads the Federation's Mosaic Center, which strives to create a more diverse and inclusive advertising industry.
Let's talk about excellence in advertising, and specifically about diversity in advertising, because that seems to be a hurdle in some respects that has been somewhat difficult to overcome, and I'm curious as to why.
There's complete agreement that we are doing much better in terms of diversity and inclusion, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. What we've done is we have concentrated on programs that connect employers with high potential students through most of our programs, that being our Most Promising Multicultural Students program and our Mosaic Career Fairs. And those programs are very successful, and usually before they graduate, the students who participate have a job offer. Oftentimes they may have multiple job offers. I think what makes that program excellent is that it's completely driven by the recruiters and the employers. We work with them very closely to make sure that we're giving them a pipeline of students who meet the criteria that they have. So, but I think in terms of where we are with diversity and inclusion within the advertising industry, we've done a really excellent job in terms of entry level, but the challenge now becomes, once we get them into the industry, how do we keep them there? And I think that's a much more difficult challenge, because then you're getting into the culture of the organization, and changing culture is much more difficult than identifying high potential students. For instance, last year we did a session for the recruiters. So we plan to start doing more work in that area, because the environment has to be welcoming and one where students feel like they have the opportunity to grow, where they feel like what they say has value, and where they can make a contribution.
You know, picking up on this conversation, it is so important in our media today. And I don't know, the Guardian recently had an article about the fact that the way that media is constructed, particularly online media these days, that you can get very myopic very quickly, right? You can only sort of get the kinds of conversations that are supposedly tailored to you. But the article points out this becomes a big part of our larger issue that we're dealing with nationally, and that is the ability to have an exchange and to have conversations with people who are unlike yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it's so important and interesting that we are having this discussion about sort of how our media companies are structured when placed against that larger discussion of how are we interacting as a society.
You know, I don't remember the statistic exactly, but I think 91% of Caucasians' social circles consist of other Caucasians.
Right.
And then, you know, it breaks up to a few percent in terms of African Americans, Hispanic, Asian Americans, other. But I think that that's really important, because if your social circle is limited and you have a somewhat limited professional circle, then the understanding of other groups isn't as great as it could be, because you don't interact with them. And, you know, just considering some of the things that's happening in the news today, I think a large part of it is not understanding and really knowing about other social circles other than the one that you come from yourself. We did some research in terms of, like, images. I think images are crucial to us moving forward and having a better understanding of one another. you know, your research indicates that a lot of the media images that you see on television portray African Americans participating in burglaries, you know, and other illicit activities.
Right.
But that's overestimated by 20% to 30%. So, you know, that's an issue in itself, in that we're not portraying different ethnic groups accurately. Also, when you look at just the, you know, entertainment, television, what you see during prime time, you know, it's a lot of reality TV right now. And I can honestly say that there are no people in my social circle who act like most of the people on reality TV. So
right. Which is maybe what makes it so riveting, but it also makes it very non-representative.
Exactly. And then, too, I was on a panel, and it's amazing. People really think because it's called reality TV that it's reality, but it's really being staged.
Right.
You know, there's someone like egging them on and, you know, letting them know how they want them to act so that it is riveting, as you said earlier.
We talked about hopefulness, and we're seeing this in newsrooms, certainly, that, as you noted, people are becoming broadcasters, and really there's this rise of citizen journalism. Do you see a rise of multiple voices, more multicultural voices that might emerge in a larger way, given that these platforms are in these folks' hands?
Oh, definitely. I think that a lot of what's going on today probably, you know, didn't just surface within the last few years, mm-hmm. but because of social media, more people know about it, and it's easier to tell, you know, a story now than it was several years ago. It used to be that, you know, you had the decision makers in the newsroom, and they decided what was news, whereas now, if I have a phone, I can decide what's news because I can put it out there in the, you know, my social media platforms myself. And if it picks up and goes viral, then it becomes news to a lot of people, not just me.
Thank you for joining Intersection as we listen to conversations with this year's Missouri Honor Medalists from the Missouri School of Journalism. I'd like to thank our producer, Sarah Shariari, and thank you to Professor Jim Flink and this year's medal recipients.